reached out and touched his sister's hand. The skin was cold. It wasn't real, he thought. It was some trick. This wasn't Kate. She couldn't be dead. And yet he knew it wasn't a trick, and this was his sister. Emma seized his arm, shaking it as she sobbed.
Michael, bring her back. Use the book. You can do that, right? Bring her back. You have to. You have to.
Michael didn't have to be told. He already had the Chronicle open, the stylus in hand, and was getting ready to prick his thumb.
I'm afraid that is not going to work.
Michael looked to where Dr. Pym stood framed against the forest.
Your sister's spirit has crossed into the land of the dead, the same place where the dire Magnus has been trapped for 40 years. His power there is very great. He will not release her.
What are you talking about? Michael demanded. He was impatient and scarcely heard the wizard's words.
There is a shadow over her,
the elf princess said, speaking for the first time.
It settled on her the moment she died.
Your sister, Dr. Pym said, is a prisoner in the land of the dead.
Chapter 23 The Ghost. Michael insisted that he at least be allowed to try to bring Kate back. The wizard agreed, but said that if he felt any resistance, he must not force it. Michael barely heard him. Pricking his thumb, he placed the bloodied tip of the stylus on the page, felt the familiar current run through him, saw Kate's face snap into focus, and began to write. He couldn't get past the second letter of her name. It was as if an invisible force stood against him. And when he tried to push back, directly disobeying the wizard's orders, he felt a crack start to open in the stylus. He stopped, panicked. And that was that. Dr. Pym urged the children not to give up hope, saying he was going to consult with Princess Wilhelmina's father and the elders among the elves, that they would find a way to free Catherine. Then the wizard and the elf princess left, and Emma collapsed against her brother, sobbing. And Michael, who felt as if he were at the bottom of a dark well and receiving only dull vibrations from the world above, put his arm about her and let her cry. The two of them stayed by Kate the rest of the day, hardly speaking. Twice Emma left to check on Gabriel, returning each time to say that he was still asleep. When night came, there was singing in the forest. It was sad and beautiful, and an elf who brought them dinner said it was a death song for the elves who had fallen in the battle. And the children listened and felt comforted. But neither was hungry, and without Dr. Pym to tell them to eat, the food remained untouched. The wizard returned some time later. He told them he had not yet found a way to free Kate from the dire Magnus's hold, and he pressed them to get some rest. Michael said he wasn't going anywhere, but he joined the wizard in demanding that Emma go to bed. Emma tried to argue, but having stayed up with Kate all the previous night, she was mumbling and heavy-lidded, and almost trembling with fatigue. Eventually she gave in. Her room was in a different tree, and she hugged Michael before she left.
"It's your birthday soon, isn't it? I guess, happy birthday."
As Emma stepped out onto the branch, Dr. Pym called for her to wait, saying he would guide her through the dark. He turned to Michael.
"What is it, my boy? I can see you have a question."
Could I have brought her back? Did I do something wrong?"
It had tortured him all day, the idea that it might have been possible to bring Kate back, if only he'd been strong enough or clever enough, and that the wizard, to spare his feelings, had placed all the blame on the dire Magnus. Dr. Pym seemed neither troubled nor surprised by Michael's question.
"No, my boy, you did nothing wrong. You never had any chance of reviving your sister. I only allowed you to try so that you could understand what it is we face.
But I almost broke the stylus.
The wizard shrugged.
Worse things might have happened. The stylus is a crutch, nothing more.
The elf who had brought dinner had also brought candles, and in the flickering light, Michael studied the old man's face and tried to divine his meaning. The answer, if there, was impossible to read.
"Tell me," Dr. Pym said, "did the Guardian give you any warnings about using the book?"
He said it would change me.
How could it not? Each experience we have changes us, and when you use the Chronicle, you live another's entire life, share their hopes and fears, their loves and hatreds. It would be very easy to become lost. You must always remember who you are.
That's what he said. But what if I'm not...
Michael...
The wizard kept his voice low and private.
I know you do not wish to be the keeper of the Chronicle. You tried to tell me so this morning, and I would not listen. The fact is, the Chronicle chose you for a reason, and I believe the choice was correct. I myself would have chosen no other.
Dr. Pym, I appreciate your trying to make me feel better, and I know it's good for team morale, but I'm just not the right person.
He had finally managed to say it. The words were out. The wizard, however, was shaking his head.
You are so, so wrong. But, Michael Wibberley, you have a fire inside of you.
Wait. What?
The wizard placed his wrinkled hand over Michael's heart.
It is the fire of true feeling, of love and compassion, of sorrow. It is the flame that ignites the Chronicle. Without it, you could never have used the book as you have. True, as yet you do not command the full power of the Chronicle, but even Catherine needed time to master the Atlas.
He reached up and gripped Michael's shoulder.
You have so much more to give than you imagine.
And so saying, he left, taking Emma with him, and Michael was alone with Kate. He tried to lie down beside her, but his heart was beating wildly, and he stood and began pacing, the Chronicle held tight to his chest. He walked back and forth in the small room for an hour or more, glancing again and again at his sister's face, as if he might catch some sign of life. The rain began all of a sudden, a fierce, pounding rain that came streaking down outside the room. Michael walked out into the darkness, still clutching the book, and allowed himself to be drenched. The rain was cold, almost freezing, but it did nothing to cool the fever burning through him, and his heart still beat as if to break free from his chest. He knew only that he couldn't go back into the room. He hurried down the winding stairs, water streaming from his glasses, his feet slipping on the wooden planks. He was being reckless, he knew, but still he went faster and faster, growing dizzier and dizzier as he circled the great tree. Then he was on the forest floor and walking quickly, not knowing or caring where, pushing his way through the thickets of ferns as his feet sank in the mud, his arms locked around the Chronicle, his heart thudding. After a while, he realized he was hearing, through the constant shushing thrum of rain, the faint sound of voices. It was the singing that he and Emma had heard before, the death song of the elves. Michael hurried toward it. Soon lights appeared, wavering among the trees, and he came upon a procession. 30 or more elves, wearing dark cloaks and carrying candles, whose flames seemed somehow impervious to the rain, were moving slowly through the forest. Michael hid behind a tree and watched them pass. Once again the song comforted him, and he felt his panic begin to ebb. Then, just as the elves disappeared among the trees, the rain stopped. Michael stood there, taking long, deep, slow breaths, and listening to the water drip from the branches. He put his hand to his chest, and his heart was no longer pounding. He found himself fingering the lump of glass under his shirt. It occurred to him that the time must be well past midnight. He was 13. By any measure, he was now the eldest Wibberley. He took the marble from around his neck and placed it on a thickly knotted root. Michael stomped down and felt the glass crunch beneath his heel. There was a hissing, and Michael stepped back as a silvery-grey mist rose into the darkness. The outlines of a figure began to take shape, the smoke moulding itself into feet and legs, a torso, arms, shoulders, a head. And as Michael watched, the swirling mist resolved into the familiar features of his father. The misty figure was identical in every way, how he was dressed, the glasses he wore, the shagginess of his hair and beard, even the fatigue in his eyes, to the figure Rourke had produced before the fortress walls. The only difference was that the figure before him was made of nothing but smoke. Michael could see straight through him to the trees beyond. "Incredible!" the figure murmured, gazing at its own ghostly hands, its voice thin and echoey, as if coming from far away. "It actually worked. But then..." The figure turned and caught sight of Michael. "Oh, my! Are you... You can't be... Michael?" Michael nodded. At the moment, nodding was all he could manage. "But you... You're so big!" Michael had been holding himself perfectly still. He hadn't known what to expect when he'd smashed the orb, but finding himself face to face with his father, or some version of his father, for the second time in as many days, had left him reeling. "Oh, my boy!" And the figure rushed forward as if to embrace him. Michael didn't have time to move, and anyway, it proved unnecessary, as the spectre passed right through him. Michael turned and saw the figure standing 2 feet behind him, looking confused and a little embarrassed. "Well, that was stupid." "Listen." Michael knew he had to regain control of the situation. "Are we in some sort of forest?" "What? Yes, but..." The figure waved its hand impatiently. "Never mind that now. There are things I have to tell you. This may be difficult to believe, but I am, in fact, I know who you are." "You do? You mean you recognize me? How could you remember?" "I saw a picture." Michael had recovered, though his voice was still shaky. "What kind of proof can you offer that you are who you look like?" "Proof? You mean like ID of some kind?" "I don't know. I just need proof." Michael felt himself becoming frantic. "How do I know you're my dad?" "Well, as it happens, I'm not." Of all possible responses, this was not one that Michael had seen coming, and it momentarily checked his rising panic. "Is your father a strange smoky apparition?" "No. Your real flesh-and-blood father is somewhere else. At least, I hope he is. I'm a reflection of Richard, only instead of reflecting just his face, I reflect everything, how he looks, his memories. For instance, I remember the last time I saw you, or rather, he saw you. It was Christmas Eve, 10 years ago. He carried you and Emma out of the house and into Stanislaus's car. You were both sleeping, and both so small." The figure was quiet for a moment, then said, "And I have his thoughts and feelings. If he were here now, looking at you, he'd be thinking exactly what I'm thinking." "What's that?" Michael asked hoarsely. "Just out of curiosity." "How much he wished to have seen you grow up." The figure stepped closer. "Michael, in giving you up, your mother and I did what we thought was best. But every day for the past 10 years, we've lived with the pain of our decision. Compared to that, captivity was easy." The figure shrugged. "Is that proof enough?" Michael was frozen with uncertainty. He wanted to believe that this was his father, or a reflection of him, but... how could he be sure?
So, you have all my dad's memories? That's right. Ask me anything. Who is King Killick? I'm sorry? Who's King Killick? If you've got my dad's memories, you should know. I'll give you a hint. He's a famous elf king.
The figure stared at him, a confused look on its face.
I have no idea.
Michael felt something crumble inside him. There, he told himself, that'll teach you to hope.
Of course, the figure continued. If you'd asked about the dwarfish King Killick, that'd be another matter. But I've never heard of an elf named Killick. Seems odd for an elf to have a dwarf's name. What? There's actually a quote of Killick's I've never forgotten. The dwarf Killick, I mean. He said, a great leader lives not in his heart, but in his head. Michael finished. Exactly. You know it too. Then why did you think Killick wasn't... Oh, I see. You were testing me. So, have I passed?
Michael nodded. He didn't trust himself to speak.
Good. The figure knelt before Michael. Then here's what I have to tell you. Your mother and I have escaped. How and who helped us aren't important. We're sending you and your sisters this message so you know we're okay. We think we know where one of the books is hidden, and we're going to look for it. But you don't have to, Michael blurted. I've already got it. What are you talking about? We went to see Hugo Algernon. We found the tomb in Malpessa. We came to Antarctica. I've got the Chronicle. See?
He held out the book. The figure reached for it, then stopped. Tendrils of smoke rose from the tips of its fingers.
Oh, dear.
What's happening? Michael asked.
I'm running out of time. This body isn't built to last. Listen to me.
The spectre placed its evaporating hands on Michael's shoulders.
That's wonderful that you have the Chronicle, but we're looking for the last book. The last... If we fail, listen, if we fail, or if you find it before we do, don't let Stanislaus bring all three books together. They must be kept separate. We've learned things. They may or may not be true, but it's not worth taking the chance.
Michael started to speak, but the figure cut him off.
You don't have to understand. Just promise me.
Michael nodded. He could see through the figure more and more clearly.
But you can't go. I'm afraid I don't have much of a choice. I can't tell you how proud I am of you, and how proud your actual father would be if he were here now.
Michael couldn't believe that this was it. There was so much he wanted to ask, so much he wanted to say. Then Michael realized that anything he told the apparition would vanish when the apparition vanished. It would be like whispering to the wind.
I lost the omnibus.
What?
The dwarf omnibus. You gave it to me the night Dr. Pym took us away. I'd been keeping it all this time. I wanted to give it back to you, but I lost it. I'm sorry. Oh, my boy. That doesn't matter. Honestly.
But Michael was shaking his head. He knew he was avoiding the thing he had to say. He took another breath.
I betrayed Kate and Emma.
The words were heavy and stuck in his throat. He had to push them out.
Last year, in Cambridge Falls, I betrayed them to the Countess. She promised she would find you and Mum. She lied, of course, and I knew what I was doing. But after... It was so awful. It hurt so much. I never wanted to feel like that again. I never wanted to feel anything again.
He was crying quietly, and he wiped his hand across his face, which was still wet from the rain. The figure said nothing.
But the Chronicle, Michael went on, it makes you feel things, and I don't want to, I can't. No one understands that. I just can't.
Then he dropped his gaze and clutched the book even tighter to his chest.
Michael. The figure had to say his name twice more before he looked up. That quote from King Killick. Do you know why I've never forgotten it? Because,
Michael said thickly. It makes good dwarfish sense?
No, because it was how I used to be, before you and your sisters, before your mother. I lived entirely in my head.
And it was better, right? Michael said. Things hurt less?
No, I mean, yes, I felt less pain.
But the point of life isn't to avoid pain. The point of life is to be alive, to feel things. That means the good and the bad. There'll be pain, but also joy and friendship and love. And it's worth it, believe me. Your mother and I lost 10 years of our lives, but every minute of every day we had our love for you and your sisters. And I wouldn't trade that for anything. Don't let the fear control you. Choose life, son.
Then the figure put its ghostly arms around him, and Michael closed his eyes, and it seemed that his father's shade became more solid, more real. Michael could feel his father's chest against his cheek, hear the beating of his heart, and then Michael opened his eyes, and he was holding nothing but air. Suddenly, he was aware of a golden glow, and he turned and saw the elf princess. She wore a cloak with a hood thrown back, and her hair shone in the darkness.
"Were you watching?"
She nodded, unashamed.
"Yes."
She stepped forward and took his hand.
"Come with me."
"Why?"
"I am going to show you how to bring back your sister."
Chapter 24. The Rise of the Dire Magnus. Hand in hand, Michael and the elf princess raced through the forest. Wilhelmina led the way, the sodden arms of the ferns swinging back to let her pass before closing on Michael and drenching him, which they did again and again. He hadn't asked where she was taking him, nor had she offered any hints, and so it was a surprise when they arrived at the canyon wall, and Michael saw a dozen cloaked figures standing about with candles. He recognized them from the procession through the forest, and indeed they were still singing, though so quietly now that Michael had to strain to hear the song. The figures were gathered before a triangular crevice, and as Michael watched, one of the elves extinguished his candle, stepped into the crevice, and disappeared.
"My people came to this valley thousands of years ago," the princess whispered, "when all was ice and snow. Have you not wondered why we chose to make such a wasteland our home?"
Michael thought about saying that he couldn't begin to fathom the workings of an elf mind. Then he decided that the correct answer was yes.
"We came," Wilhelmina said, "because our race is drawn to the places where the mortal world and the spirit world overlap. Imagine two circles, their edges touching, and a narrow space that belongs not to one world or the other, but to both. That is what exists in this valley, what exists here."
And she nodded at the crevice in the wall.
"You mean,"
Michael said, "that cave takes you into the land of the dead?"
"Yes and no. The true land of the dead is a place the living do not venture. The cave leads to the in-between place where the circles touch, and there the dead can come to us. Did you not feel this when you first entered the valley? A presence you could not explain?"
And Michael realized that he had felt it, that when he and Gabriel and Emma had come into the valley, he'd had the sense that they were not alone, that something was looking over their shoulders, but he dismissed the feeling as nerves. He watched as a cloaked elf extinguished her candle and entered the crevice.
"What are they doing?" "They go to say farewell to those who died in battle. None can stay long in that place, but there is time enough to say the things that must be said. Then each will return to their own world, the living to the living, the dead to the dead."
Michael looked at the elf princess.
"I should have tried to bring them back. The elves who died, I should have used the chronicle. I wasn't thinking. I'm so sorry."
Wilhelmina shook her head.
Death is part of nature. This was their time, and they died bravely. Your sister is different. Her journey among the living is not yet finished.
She looked toward the crevice.
And if the enemy will not allow her to come here, then you must go there.
Michael understood. He swallowed and tightened his grip on the chronicle.
Does Dr. Pym know about all this? Certainly. He knows of this place, but he does not know I have brought you here. Indeed, in council with my father and the elders, he has spoken against sending you into the fold.
The fold?
That is what we call the place where the worlds overlap. The wizard knows you must travel there alone, and that he would have no power to protect you. He is searching for a safer way to free your sister, but there is no safer way.
Why do I have to go alone? What about the elves who are already in there?
You will not see them. Even if you and I were to enter side by side, we would find ourselves far apart. You might discover yourself in a city, while I would be on a vast, empty field. The fold changes for each of us, and is always different.
Michael felt that the more she told him, the more confused he became. He just wanted to know one thing.
How do I find Kate? Simply hold the idea of your sister in your mind, and she will come to you. But be warned, others have stayed too long and been unable to find their way back. You must be quick, Michael.
That's the first time you've called me by my name. Wilhelmina smiled.
I think you are not a rabbit any more.
Michael looked at her, and the memory of that brief time when he had shared her life came back to him. He remembered the darkness and despair she'd suffered during her long years as a prisoner. But he also recalled the deep, unquenchable joy she took from the world around her, and he knew that given the choice, Wilhelmina would suffer through all she had, and more, rather than sacrifice one day of being alive. It was just as his father had said, she chose life, all of it. Then Michael did something that surprised even him. He leaned in and kissed the elf princess. Her lips were soft, and he couldn't tell if it was magic or not, but he felt a warmth spreading over his cheeks and ears, down his neck and across his chest. He said,
"Thank you,"
and turned and walked past the gathered elves and into the cave, taking the warmth of the kiss with him. After only a few feet, he could see nothing but blackness. He stumbled repeatedly on the rocky floor, but continued creeping forward, one hand held out before him, the memory of Kate clear and strong in his mind. Then, in the distance, Michael perceived a dim grey light. He made for it, and the darkness around him faded, and the floor became smooth. He realized he was no longer in a cave, but a corridor of some kind. Then Michael stepped into the light and gasped. He was standing in the great hall of an old stone church. He took in the rows of columns, the stained glass windows, the vaulted ceiling. Strangely, instead of pews, there were lines of cots running down the center aisle. The church appeared to be empty. Then Michael heard, faint and echoing, the sound of a violin. Emma woke and knew that something was wrong. She sat up and looked about. Her room was similar to her sister's, but in a different tree, several hundred feet away. Pulling on a pair of soft leather shoes, a gift from the elves, as she had lost a boot in the volcano, Emma walked out onto the branch that served both as a balcony and a bridge to the rest of the forest. Water was pooled all about. More dripped from the trees. Clearly there'd been a rainstorm. How had it not woken her? Emma had the terrible thought that she'd slept through an entire day and into the next night. She started off toward the tree where she'd left her brother and sister. She forced herself to go slowly, as the branches were slick with rain and the night was murky and black. Arriving in Kate's room, she found her sister exactly as she'd left her, and Michael nowhere to be seen. But standing beside Kate's bed was Gabriel. He looked to be completely recovered from his injuries,
and as he turned, Emma ran forward and hugged him. She said his name over and over, and he held her, and she felt safe in a way she had not felt since she'd arrived at the elf village, and even the darkness about them seemed to recede just a little. Emma stepped back and wiped her eyes.
"What are you doing here? I thought you were still asleep."
"I woke and was much better. When I heard about your sister, I had to come."
Still holding Gabriel's hand, Emma knelt beside the bed. Her sister's brow was smooth. Death had erased the furrow of worry.
"Where's Michael? He's supposed to be here."
Gabriel shook his head.
"There was no one here when I arrived."
"Something is wrong. I knew it. Michael should be here."
Gabriel was silent for a long moment. It was as if he were listening to something far away, though all Emma could hear was the steady dripping of rain.
"I think he has gone to try and bring back your sister."
"But he already did that. He tried writing her name in the book, and he couldn't."
"There is another way, a dangerous way. He can seek out her spirit directly. The wizard could have shown him how."
"What? Why wouldn't he tell me?"
"No doubt he was trying to protect you."
"But she's my sister, too. We got to find them."
"Come, then. I know where to look. It may be they need our help."
Emma leaned down and whispered to Kate that she loved her and would be back soon. Then she rose, and she and Gabriel hurried from the room. Michael followed the music down the nave of the church, past the rows of cots, and through a door in the back wall. He found himself at the base of a tower. In the middle of the floor, a large bell lay on its side, its iron shell cracked in two. A rickety-looking wooden staircase spiraled upward along the walls. Michael stood there, listening to the song of the violin echoing through the tower. Then he began to climb. The elf princess had said that the fold was different for everyone. But where had this old church come from, and what did it mean? Was he right in following the music? Would it lead him to Kate? And who, he wondered, was playing it? The staircase ended, and Michael found a ladder leading through a trap door in the ceiling. Tucking the chronicle under his arm, Michael headed upward, emerging onto a wide wooden platform atop the tower. Stone columns around the edge of the platform supported a peaked roof, and three iron bells hung suspended in the rafters. There was a hole in the center of the floor where, presumably, the fourth bell had fallen through. The church stood in an endless field of mist.
"Am I still in the cave?" Michael wondered. "Or am I somewhere else?"
He felt confused and frightened and very alone. Kate was nowhere to be seen, but he had found the source of the music. A boy, a few years older than Michael, with unruly dark hair and dressed in worn, vaguely old-fashioned clothes, stood at the edge of the belfry playing a battered violin. His fingers were dirty, but he played with an easy, fluid precision, and his eyes were closed, as if he was lost in the music. Michael stood there, unsure, waiting. The song died away. The boy lowered the violin.
"My mother taught me that. I used to play it for her. My name's Rafe."
"I'm Michael."
"I know."
What is this place?"
"The church."
The boy reached out to one of the columns supporting the roof. There was something sad and loving in the way he touched it.
"This is a place that no longer exists in the living world. It was where I came to know your sister. The fold, to use the elves' word, can be manipulated if one has the will and power. When I felt you coming, the church seemed an appropriate choice. But perhaps it's merely sentimental."
He looked at Michael. His eyes were a startling shade of green, and Michael knew then who he was, and that he was not a boy at all. He was their enemy.
"Where is she?"
"Behind you."
Michael turned. A large desk stood where none had stood before, and his sister lay upon it, wearing the same high-necked, white lace dress that Michael remembered. Her eyes were closed, her face pale, and her hands were folded on her chest. He walked over and touched her arm. It was solid. She was real.
"You're keeping her here, aren't you?"
"Yes, I am."
"Why?"
"I think you know the answer to that."
Michael said nothing. He sensed the boy had come up behind him.
"My followers in the living world have preserved my physical body for decades. They are waiting for it to rise, for me to rise. As keeper of the Chronicle, you have the power to restore me to life. Release my spirit, and I will release your sister. Otherwise, she stays with me."
Michael felt a cold weight settle in his stomach. This was why Dr. Pym hadn't wanted him to come here. He'd known that Michael would be faced with this exact choice, either to bring his sister back and also bring back the Dire Magnus, or to leave Kate trapped in the land of the dead forever. Only there was no choice, not for Michael. He didn't care if the Dire Magnus returned to life and regained all his old power. He didn't care that he would be responsible for all that happened afterward. Kate was what mattered. She was all that mattered. Michael would bring back the Dire Magnus 100 times over if his sister would just open her eyes and speak to him. And perhaps that was what the wizard had truly feared. It seemed to Michael he could hear another violin in the distance, playing a different song from before, one that was both faster and more haunting, less human.
"Come, make your decision."
"I already have." Michael opened the Chronicle on the desk and snapped the stylus free from the brackets.
"Your hands are shaking. There's no need to be scared."
"I'm not." It was true, he wasn't. The shaking was nerves, the knowledge that he was doing something both momentous and wrong, but which he couldn't help. He wanted his sister back, and he would pay any price. And letting the Dire Magnus return to the world was only part of the cost. Michael knew that everything he'd experienced before, Emma's feelings of betrayal, the elf princess's despair at her long imprisonment, the Guardian's guilt and madness, was nothing compared to the darkness and hatred he would find inside the Dire Magnus. And the moment he called on the magic of the Chronicle, all that darkness, all that hatred, would become his. There was no way he wouldn't be changed. Michael knew all that, and again, he didn't care. He held his thumb on the table and pricked it with the stylus. He turned to the boy. "Release Kate, then I'll bring you back." The boy smiled.
"This isn't a negotiation. I go first, or I take your sister away to a place where you can't follow, and that will be the end."
How do I know you'll let her go?" The boy, who called himself Rafe, reached out and gently moved the hair off Kate's forehead.
"Because I want her to live just as much as you do."
And Michael looked at the boy's shining green eyes and believed him. The boy gripped Michael's arm, his voice suddenly cold and commanding.
"Now write my name."
And Michael set the tip of the stylus on the page and wrote in smoking, bloody letters, "The Dire Magnus." The next instant, he was a man, lean and hawk-featured, but with the same startling green eyes, living in a dusty, war-torn land. The man was a village sorcerer. He was hard and proud, but Michael felt his love for the people he protected, and for his own young family, his wife and child, and indeed, Michael felt that they were his people, his family. And when the man returned home to find his village burned, his family murdered, it was Michael's heart that turned black with hatred and guilt. Together, Michael and the man hunted down and punished the men responsible, and Michael reveled in the suffering the man caused, that he caused. And when their revenge had been taken, the man's rage then turned upon all men, all humans, and Michael felt himself burning with the same anger. Michael gripped the stylus tight in his fist. He was trembling badly, struggling to hold on to himself. The magic pulled him down once more. He was old. He had travelled far, learned much, gained more power, and now he was dying. It was night. There was a fire, and Michael stared across the flames at a boy with emerald green eyes, and heard himself, in a hoarse, wavering voice, speak of three books of unfathomable power, and tell the boy that they, that he, for the man and the boy were one, would use the books to change the world. Then the man took a knife and drew it across his own throat, and Michael became the boy. More time passed. The boy, who had sat across the fire, was long dead, his bones dust. Yet still he was alive, just as the first man was alive, as Michael was alive, in the body of another, a man with the same blazing green eyes. The man was whispering in the ear of a youthful conqueror as they sacked a city on the sea, and Michael stalked through streets filled with fire and screaming, and he felt a terrible high joy at being so near his goal. And then Michael and the man descended to the vaults below the tower and found the books already gone, and Michael felt a thousand years of anger rise up and consume him. Michael felt himself falling deeper and deeper into darkness, and there was nothing he could do to stop it, no part of himself he could cling to. Centuries passed. The world changed. Michael died and was reborn, died and was reborn. The books eluded him, but he gained power, and with power, followers. And with every year that passed, Michael felt the faces of the first man's wife and child becoming more and more blurred and indistinct. He was another man, this one tall and fair-haired, but with the same emerald eyes, carrying inside himself half a dozen lives, half a dozen deaths, and he was listening to a prophecy about three children who would find the books and bring them together. Three children who would be sacrificed so that a new world might come into being. And more deaths, more lives. Michael became aware of a strain inside the man, inside himself, as each life was coupled to the one before. Then Michael was an old man, older than he had ever been. His bones were twisted, his breath weak and watery. He stood in a candle-lit ballroom surrounded by dark figures. Then the crowd of figures parted, and a boy stepped forward. Michael recognized Rafe, and saw he held Kate in his arms, and a forgotten part of Michael came alive at the sight of his sister. She was wounded, bleeding, and Rafe was trading himself for Kate, his life for hers, and there was anguish in the boy's face. Then suddenly Kate was gone. And it was happening again. Michael was dying, and he felt the dire Magnus' spirit attaching itself like a cancer to the boy's soul. But something was different from all the times before, and the difference, Michael realized, was in Rafe.
"That will do, I think."
The stylus was plucked from Michael's hand. He collapsed against the desk, gasping and covered in sweat. He felt as if he'd been poisoned. Hatred and anger still coursed through his body. He struggled to stay on his feet. The boy's green eyes glittered.
"Did you enjoy your trip through my various lives? I imagine it was a bit overwhelming. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this, Michael. But before I go..."
He clenched his hand, and the stylus snapped.
"What are you... Oh, I fully intend to let you bring Kate back to life. Just not today. I need to take care of a few things first, and I can keep a closer eye on her down here. You, however, should leave. I would say that you've already stayed too long."
The boy was fading from sight, becoming misty and insubstantial. Michael lunged forward, but his hand passed through the boy's arm.
"Stop, please! Goodbye, Michael. We'll meet again soon."
The pieces of the stylus clattered onto the floor, and Michael was alone. He scrabbled at the fragments, but the tower shook, and one of them rolled away, disappearing between the boards of the platform. Michael let the remaining shards fall from his hand. It was hopeless. He looked and saw the mist rising up and rolling in waves toward the church. He'd failed. More than that, he'd made things worse. And how could he bring Kate back now? What would he tell Dr. Pym? What would he tell Emma? He turned to the desk and took Kate's hand. It was cold.
I'm sorry, he whispered. I tried. I really did.
Michael felt a darkness welling up inside him, and his despair turned to rage.
This wasn't fair. This shouldn't be happening, not to Kate, not to him. It was Dr. Pym's fault. It was their parents' fault. They should be the ones here. He wished they were dead, not...
A voice spoke inside his head.
The book will change you. Remember who you are.
That's not me, Michael thought. That's the Dire Magnus. It's not me. And he looked at his sister's face, focused on her, and he felt the rage and the darkness recede. It was still there, deep inside him, the same way the other memories were there, Emma's and the Guardian's and Wilhelmina's, but he remembered who he was. Seconds passed. Michael knew he needed to go, but he wouldn't leave his sister. Indeed, he couldn't. He'd used the last of his strength beating back the Dire Magnus's poison. That, on top of everything else, the loss of Kate, the meeting with his father, Michael's simple human exhaustion, it was too much. He was finished, and something in his chest seemed to crack open, and all the feelings he'd been bottling up for months, all the guilt and the sadness and the shame, came surging forth. Michael rested his head against the still-open book and sobbed. Sometime later, a few seconds, an eternity, he heard a strange sort of hissing. Michael rose up and wiped his eyes. His tears were sizzling on the page. Nor was that all. The book itself was on fire. Flames licked around the edges of the cover. They crawled across the page. But the book and Michael's hand that rested on the book remained unharmed. Michael pulled his hand away, and the flames died. For a long moment, he was too stunned to have any thoughts at all. Then the tower shuddered, the bells clanged, and his brain jolted to life. He thought about the pattern of flames carved into the book's cover, the way the letters would bubble and smoke when he wrote someone's name. He thought of the wizard saying, "You have a fire inside of you." Did that mean he had caused the flames, or had the book sensed something in him and the flames were its response? Either way, somehow, without using his blood, without the stylus, he'd tapped into the power of the Chronicle. And he'd done so, he sensed, at a deeper level than ever before. But what good did it do him? Without the stylus, he couldn't write Kate's name. Another memory came to him. He was in the elf village, and Dr. Pym was saying that the stylus was a crutch, nothing more. At the time, Michael had had no idea what he'd meant, but what if... Michael felt the excitement of the idea surging through him. What if the stylus was like the photos they'd first used to tap into the power of the Atlas? Eventually, Kate had been able to command the Atlas at will. Could the same be true here? Could the stylus be just a means of accessing the Chronicle's power until one had mastered its workings? He thought about the fact that the Dire Magnus, having broken the stylus himself, still meant to bring Kate back to life. The stylus couldn't be the only way of using the Chronicle. The tower shook. Fingers of grey mist slithered over the lip of the platform. Michael placed his hand on the open page and focused all his attention on his sister. He was seeing things with an eerie, perfect clarity. He realized that all the time the Chronicle had flooded him with the feelings of others, of Emma and the Guardian and Princess Wilhelmina, it had wanted his feelings, his heart. On some level, Michael suspected that he'd known this all along, that this was the reason he'd tried so hard to push the Chronicle away, except that the Chronicle was his responsibility. Michael understood that now and accepted it. Remember who you are. I'm Michael Wibberley, he thought. I'm the brother of Kate and Emma. And he reached down to the feeling that formed the very bedrock of his life, his love for his sisters, and offered it up. His eyes were closed, but he heard the whoop of flames.
Suddenly, Michael found himself in a high-ceilinged, narrow-windowed room filled with 20 or more beds in neat rows. There were Christmas decorations on the walls, and Michael recognized the dormitory of the orphanage in Boston, where he and his sisters had lived just after their parents had disappeared. Kate held Emma in her lap, and Michael saw himself, 3 years old and already wearing glasses, sitting at the end of her bed. Kate was telling them that one day their parents would return and they would all have Christmas together, but that Michael and Emma had to believe it would happen, that only then would it come true. Kate was 5 years old, and Michael marveled at her strength. He was in Richmond, Virginia, the orphanage in Boston having burned down years before. Their parents still had not returned. Their Richmond orphanage was in an old tobacco warehouse on the banks of the James River. It was summer, and Kate had taken her brother and sister to the river, and they were splashing each other and leaping from high rocks into a deep pool. And Michael felt Kate's own happiness at seeing her brother and sister happy and carefree. Then they were in a different orphanage, this one next to a fancy private school, and Kate was sneaking them into the school's library to read them stories in the dark, empty corners of the stacks. And he was with Kate as she fought with one orphanage director after another who tried to split them up. He stayed up with her half the night before his and Emma's birthdays, putting together presents that she had worked on and saved for month after month, all so that he and Emma would have something special to open. Michael saw the million small ways she tried to make their lives a little better, most of which he'd never acknowledged or had taken for granted, and though the orphanages changed and they all grew older, Michael felt how Kate's love for her brother and sister remained as strong and constant and fierce as ever. And he understood that there was nothing he could do to lose it, and when he took his hand away from the book, his vision was blurry with tears, and he watched as his sister's body grew faint and ghostly and, finally, disappeared. He stood there, taking long, ragged, trembling breaths. He felt emptied out, but also complete. The dire Magnus's darkness no longer threatened to rise up and consume him. His sister had given him new strength. More than that, she was his strength. The tower swayed and shuddered. Mist clawed at his ankles, and Michael knew he had to go. Snapping the book closed, he raced for the trapdoor. He leaped down the tower stairs three at a time. When he reached the bottom, he heard a crashing and splintering from above and knew that one of the bells had broken free. He didn't look up, but kept running and was already in the great hall when there was a deafening clang and the floor shook beneath his feet. The church was disintegrating, the walls and ceiling fading into mist. On either side of him, past the rows of cots, there was nothing but fog, stretching on and on. He could still see the doorway that led to the tunnel, and he raced toward it as the floor turned to smoke. Michael dropped to his knees just beyond the mouth of the crevice, taking gulps of cool, clean air. He had stumbled along in darkness, tripping again and again on the rocks that jutted up from the tunnel floor. Finally, there'd been a light in the distance, and he'd made for it, knowing what it was, knowing who it was. Now the golden glow was all about him as the elf princess leaned close and her shining hair fell forward.
"Are you all right? Are you hurt?"
Michael felt her hand on the back of his neck, and he sensed the other elves waiting nearby. He stood slowly, uncertain of his legs.
"Yes, I'm okay."
But his hand trembled as he adjusted his glasses.
"Did you find your sister? Did you bring her back? Where is the stylus? What happened? Speak to me."
Michael looked down at the chronicle. His fingers were curled tight around the spine. Yes, the stylus was gone, but his connection to the book was stronger than ever. The chronicle was a part of him now. He looked at the elf princess.
"I need to see her."
Hand in hand once more, Michael and the elf princess hurried through the forest. The ferns were still wet from the rainstorm, and Michael was drenched all over again. When they reached the elf village, there were lights moving in the branches far above. The princess led him to his sister's tree and up the spiraling stairs. Just outside her room, Michael stopped. The elf princess turned toward him, her face illuminated in the candlelight shining through the doorway.
"What is it?"
"What if," Michael whispered,
"what if she's not?"
Wilhelmina squeezed his hand and smiled.
"Come."
Two more steps brought him into the room, and there was Dr. Pym, bent forward over his sister, speaking softly. And there was Kate, sitting up, her eyes open, nodding as she listened, and Michael didn't hear the cry that erupted from his throat. He only knew that a moment later he was in his sister's arms, sobbing, and he could feel Kate's cheek against the top of his head, and he could hear the beating of her heart, and he could hear her voice saying his name over and over. Michael wanted to tell her how much he'd missed her, how much he loved her, that he had kept his promise, that Emma was safe, but he couldn't speak. And finally, it was Kate who drew away. She put her hands on the sides of his face and lifted it so he was looking into her eyes. There were tears on her cheeks, but she was smiling.
"Michael, did you bring me back? Dr. Pym said you were the only one who could. How did you do it?"
Michael took a deep breath and wiped at his eyes. He could feel the wizard watching him. Kate was back. She was alive. It was time to face the consequences of what he had done, and he opened his mouth to tell them about the green-eyed boy, about the Dire Magnus, when the wizard said,
"I also am eager to hear the story, but let us save the explanation till Emma arrives. I sent for her as soon as Catherine began to stir. She should be here in a moment."
"No, she is gone."
And Michael and Kate and the wizard all turned to see Gabriel enter and step past the elf princess.
"I went to her room, but it was empty. She is gone."
"Gabriel, are you sure this is the right place?" Emma asked. "There's no one here."
"I am sure."
They were at the edge of the clearing where, two nights before, Emma and Michael had watched the elves have their picnic, where Emma had been abducted by the dragon Wilhelmina, and where Rourke had built the portal to bring through his army. The portal, its fire quenched, stood in the center of the clearing, half a dozen felled trees fashioned into a rough arch.
"We must be patient," the man said.
Since leaving the elf village, Emma had several times been on the verge of mentioning her fear that no matter what they did, Kate was lost for good. Mostly she just wanted to be reassured, but each time she thought of her sister lying there so pale and still, it took all of Emma's strength to keep from crying. And beyond that, there was something in her friend's silence, some new unsettling quality, and it kept her from speaking. Without warning, the wooden archway burst into flame. Emma gasped.
"Did you know that was going to happen?"
"Yes."
"What's it mean?"
"This portal leads to a stronghold of the Dire Magnus. It was from that stronghold that the army came through yesterday. And it is where, for decades, the body of the master has been preserved."
Emma wanted to ask what master he was talking about, and what did some stupid portal have to do with bringing back her sister. She was confused and starting to feel a little bit scared, when, from deep in the forest, she heard shouting. Emma listened. Someone was calling her name, but the voice, it couldn't be. Then a hand gripped her arm. There was a shimmer in the air, and Emma saw that the face beside her was no longer her friend's, and screamed. Afterward, they put together what must have happened, how Rourke must have survived the fall from the fortress tower, how he must have entered the village under the cover of a glamour, disguised as Gabriel, and lured Emma away. It even came out that the pair had been seen heading into the forest. but that was all later. Immediately after Gabriel failed to find Emma, Wilhelmina roused the village, and elves streamed out into the valley. Word soon came back that the wooden archway in the clearing was on fire once again. They were too late, of course. By the time Kate and Michael and the wizard arrived at the clearing, Gabriel had sprinted ahead with the elves. Emma was gone, and the wooden arch had collapsed into a smouldering jumble. Anton, the blue-eyed elf captain, had gotten there first, just in time to see Rourke carry a screaming, kicking Emma through the portal. He said there had been another figure as well, but it was strange, for at one moment the figure had seemed to be a man, and the next a boy. Both man and boy, the elf captain said, had the same startling green eyes. Then Kate grabbed at Dr. Pym, crying, "It was him, wasn't it? It was Rafe!" But the wizard didn't reply, for Michael had run forward and was pulling at the burning timbers with his bare hands and shouting his sister's name. And the others had to come and lift him away. This is Jim Dale. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Fire Chronicle, Book 2, The Books of Beginning, by John Stevens. This program was directed by John McElroy, producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2012 by John Stevens. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.